authorities and, by implication, the French president himself, Emmanuel Macron, for failing to prevent the crossings.
Many make these dangerous journeys because of the impact of British conflicts on their homelands. A number of observers now believe that Britain must accept responsibility for causing much of the migrant problem. It seems a tragic irony that after travelling thousands of perilous kilometres from their war-torn homelands, desperate migrants seeking a new life drown within sight of the very country that turned them into refugees.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio programme. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
in the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you remember, we had a survey of Imam Khomeini's testament in a number of episodes, and last episode, you heard the concluding part of the testament. Today, you're going to hear his marriage with Lady Khadija Saghafi. Stay tuned for more. Lady Khadija Saghafi was Imam Khomeini's wife. She was a virtuous lady while she was well aware of social and political developments of her time. A brief glance at her marital life shows that she was a very patient woman, as she had to accompany the greatest contemporary personality, Imam Khomeini, who successfully changed the course of history against the will of oppressors and tyrants. Miss Saghafi was the lady who tolerated the hard times of Imam Khomeini's arrest, several month separation, his life in exile in Turkey and then Iraq under tough conditions. This great lady was undoubtedly a major factor in all phases of the Imam's struggles and successes. Khadija Saghafi, also known as Qudsi and Quds-e Iran, was born in 1914 in a religious family. Her father, Ayatollah Mirza Muhammad Saghafi, was one of the great ulema in Tehran, whose ancestors were clergymen for generations. Her mother, however, was from a well-to-do family. Hence, Khadija grew up with no financial problem. Young Khadija lived 15 years with her grandmother, who had no child. Yet, the wealthy life didn't prevent her from acquiring ethical merits. She was a hard-working girl, and she spent her elementary school and part of her high school to learn French. This enthusiasm for knowledge continued through her marital life, even when she gave birth to her fourth child. Lady Khadija Saghafi endured all problems of migration to Qom and living in difficult conditions with Imam Khomeini, as the Imam was a pain in the neck of the Pahlavi regime. Lady Khadija Saghafi loved studying and would rarely spend her day without studying a book or a newspaper or a magazine. Recitation of the Noble Quran was also part of her daily works. She had also studied the Divan of Hafiz, Golestan of Sa'di, and many literary and historical books. She knew many poems by heart. Imam Khomeini's wife was so interested in reading books that the last years of her life she would ask others to read books for, as she could not read due to old age. Imam Khomeini was studying till the age of 26 in the holy city of Qom. He lived only with the money that received from his family in Khomeini and would never accept the stipend that the sources of emulation sent to him. Miss Khadija Saghafi was introduced to Imam Khomeini by Ayatollah Sayyid Ahmad Lavasani, and the former accepted as he had an old age friendship with Miss Sagafi's father. However, the difference of living conditions of the two families caused a wave of opposition against this marriage. Lady Khadija Sagafi writes on this, "The opposition increased. Basically, it was considered impossible that I would be the wife of a seminary student. For these reasons, my dear father explained in detail to Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Lavasani as why this proposal was impossible. My father had told him that this was very problematic. This girl would not be allowed to cope with the life of a seminary student. It is true that Mr. Ruhullah Imam Khomeini is very pious and God-wary, who has gained the degree of ijtihad at a young age, and he has studied philosophy and irfan, Islamic Gnosticism, regularly, and is a man of both knowledge and practice. I know Mr. Khomeini, and I know that his knowledge is more than his age, and he has a bright future. Yet, Qudsi and her grandfather consider a big number of problems. The proposal for marriage was presented several times, but each time the answer was disappointing. Finally, Lady Khadija Sagafi gave the positive answer to the marriage proposal after 9 months. The positive answer was mainly because of the three dreams that she had seen. Khadija Sagafi relates one of her dreams as follows. I saw in a dream that there was a small room in a house in which three men were sitting while I and a lady who had a special chador were sitting in the opposite room. The lady answered my questions. I asked her as who those men were. She answered, "The man in the opposite is the Prophet, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, who has a black turban. On his side, the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali, peace upon him, is sitting, who has a green turban, and on the other side, Imam Hassan, peace upon him, is sitting also with a black turban." I was very happy and asked, "So these are my prophet and imams?" She answered bitterly, "But you do not accept them." As I was thumping my chest, I said angrily, "What are you saying? I love them very much, and I consider myself among their ummah, and I have obeyed what they have said, and I will obey what they will say." At this time, I woke up. Thus, the ceremony of proposal for marriage was done shortly after the dream of Khadija Sagafi. Interestingly, the house of Khadija and Ruhullah was the same that she had seen in her dream. She writes, "The day after the marriage, I noticed that this is the same house that I had dreamt. This is the same room where I had dreamt the Prophet, the Commander of the Faithful, and Imam Hassan. Even the door and the window are the same which my mother had prepared for me after the dream."
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The United States, Britain, Europe, and Canada moved to block certain Russian banks' access to the SWIFT international payment system as part of more sanctions against Moscow as it continues its military operation against Ukraine.
We are resolved to continue imposing massive costs on Russia, costs that will further isolate Russia from the international financial system and our economies.
The measures, which will also include restrictions on the Russian central bank's international reserves, will be implemented in the coming days.
We will paralyze the assets of Russia's central bank. This will freeze its transactions, and it made it impossible for the central bank to liquidate assets.
Von der Leyen said removing Russia from SWIFT will paralyze Russia's international trade and effectively stop its imports and exports. Earlier, Berlin announced it has agreed to limit Moscow's access to SWIFT as well. The SWIFT system is a Belgian cooperative that offers many services in assisting businesses and individuals to complete seamless and accurate business transactions. Western countries have joined the chorus as well. The US says Western nations will also impose restrictive measures on the Russian central bank to prevent it from deploying its international reserves in ways that undermine the impact of sanctions. But how much damage will these sanctions have on the fragile global economy? The sanctions add to the economic impact of this crisis and will transmit primarily through energy prices as well as grain prices. Russia and Ukraine supply crops to a long list of countries around the world, including large volumes to buyers in the Middle East and Africa. Sanctions will also add to a growing concern of inflation. This could throw the EU economy into mayhem or even negatively affect Russia's gas supplies to Europe. The EU is Russia's biggest trade partner. Nearly 38% of Russia's exports went to the EU, while over 36% of Russia's imports came from Europe. Russia is also the origin of 26% of the EU's oil imports and 40% of the EU's gas imports. The world energy market and commodities have been affected and will continue to witness price surges, especially when it comes to oil. On Thursday, oil prices briefly topped $100 for the first time since 2014. The US and several of its allies, including the European Union and the United Kingdom, have vowed to impose further restrictions on Moscow as punishment. In total, the sanctions will keep approximately $1 trillion in Russian banking assets from flowing through the markets of the US and its partners' financial systems. The sanctions also limit tech exports to Russia and squeeze the country's tech industry. Though sanctions are the main foreign policy tool of Americans, the effectiveness of this tactic is debated. The sanctions already announced are significant in size and scope, but the long-time American reliance on sanctions has left the US with few other options if Russia does not respond. Experts say Russia's sanctions are a big deal, but it could take quite a while, even years, for the sanctions to hurt the Russian economy.
They think they can destroy Russia and China by cutting them off. They cannot. It's a false dream. And it, unfortunately, if they continue, it probably will lead to war, perhaps nuclear war, and the annihilation of the human race.
Russian officials dismiss Western sanctions as ineffective. Russia's GDP has grown yet at a slow rate since the West imposed financial sanctions on Russia in 2014. The country's officials also point to low inflation, the minimal budget deficit, a public debt of only 18% of GDP at the end of 2020, steady current account surpluses, and international currency reserves of $596 billion at the end of 2020. Russians have got used to sanctions and therefore adapted their economy to them.
Almost 2 years after African-American George Floyd died beneath the knee of a white police officer on a street in Minneapolis, the police officers involved are being brought to account. A federal jury has found three former officers present at the scene of Floyd's arrest guilty of depriving the man of his civil rights. The jury found the conduct of the three officers led to Floyd's death, a charge that would impact the final verdict the officers will face. The three are convicted of failing to stop Derek Chauvin, who knelt on Floyd's neck for about 9 minutes, and denying Floyd's constitutional right to medical care while in custody. Tu Tao, Alexander Quang, and Thomas Lane will remain free on bail until their hearings, which aren't scheduled yet. What's for certain is that they'll face several years in prison. Chauvin, the officer arresting Floyd, was sentenced to 22 and a half years last year. For Floyd's family, it's not enough.
This is just accountability. It can never be justice because I can never get George back. And no matter how many times that I pray at night and I think about my brother 24/7, it still is going to be hard, even though we just had a federal conviction and we already had the state conviction. But times, you know, will be probably a lot harder for me still because I can't get my brother back.
The trials are considered historic in the U.S., where officers are hardly ever indicted for the treatment of the members of the black community. Racism in the United States dates back as long as its history. African Americans have suffered tremendous atrocities at the hands of white slave owners over the years, and the impact it made on American society can be observed to this day. One of the early cases of police racism can be traced back to the early 1700s when South Carolina launched America's first law enforcement force, dubbed the Slave Patrol. As the title suggests, the patrols were tasked with hunting down black people and selling them into slavery. Following a devastating civil war, slavery in the U.S. was abolished in 1865, but the results the anti-slavery camp was looking for didn't come to pass. Wealthy plantation owners in the South found loopholes in the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution and created what later became known as the Black Codes, the rules and regulations that appeared to have acknowledged the abolition but created the same slavery conditions in essence. Among the many racist provisions in the codes is the criminalization of vagrancy for black people. This meant that law enforcement was free to arrest and charge any black person who didn't have a job. The codes were a precursor to Jim Crow laws, which enforced racial segregation in the South and lasted until the mid-20th century. The recent killings and mistreatment of the black people are reminiscent of the lynching of African Americans and the destruction of their properties by the Ku Klux Klan and other hate groups throughout the years.
So I guess the main root is, you know, this country has been founded on a system of white supremacy, racism, and genocide. It's founded on a system of inequality with a purpose, right? Racism with a purpose. The purpose is to create almost a group of second class citizens who the country can feed off of, right? We can feed off of their labor. We can feed off of their work. We can feed off of their existence.
U.S. President Joe Biden staked much of his presidency on a promise to fight racism in the country, managing to garner the support from a large portion of the African-American society. But with many lawmakers balking at even the idea of police reforms, can the president make good on his pledge?
You know, police reform and police brutality is a big issue for black and brown folks and for poor and working class folks here in the United States. But the U.S. politicians don't represent those people or those interests in this country. They represent a rich interest, the interest of the ruling class. And so, you know, they're not interested in police reform. So this bill, you know, essentially has died in the Senate and will probably never get passed because of the fact that, you know, there's no interest by U.S. policymakers to get it passed. There's no interest to do what the citizens want them to do.
George Floyd wasn't the first African-American who lost his life over what could otherwise be considered as an inconsequential offense for a white person, and certainly has not been the last. But the waves of scrutiny such cases bring up in their wake are indeed making a positive, albeit limited, impact.
Vienna's Palais Cobourg Hotel, the venue of marathon talks between Iran and the P4+1 group. It has once again become the center of a lot of attention, as parties involved in the tough negotiations have signaled significant progress despite the complexity of some issues. The eighth round, which began on December 27th, has now become one of the longest rounds of talks between Iran and the P4+1, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany. Iran and the P4+1 are completing a draft text of an agreement to revive the 2015 deal. Most of the delegations acknowledge that the talks have reached a critical stage. The diplomacy seems to be approaching a make-or-break moment. Iran's lead negotiator says being near the finish line does not guarantee crossing it. Ali Bagheri-Kani says it requires extra caution, much perseverance, additional creativity, and a balanced approach to take the last step. The Iranian diplomat points out that to finish the job, there are certain decisions that the Western parties to the negotiations need to take.
Thus far, the West has been reluctant to make any sweeping political decisions that are necessary to bring the United States back into the plan. Iran isn't just going to forget the very many U.S. and Western provocations since the United States left the plan in 2018, and they understand that there are many political camps competing at once for power. The West needs to make sweeping political decisions that will definitively outline the future of U.S. involvement in the plan.
Iran says its initiatives pave the way for the progress in the negotiations and that a good deal is within reach in the Austrian capital. Tehran believes that the ball is now in the West's court, and if it shows serious determination, a good deal can emerge. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi says Tehran seeks a lasting deal, not a fragile one. The president has noted that credible guarantees, putting an end to political claims and effective removal of sanctions are necessary for a lasting deal with the P4+1 group. But what are the characteristics of a lasting deal? The 2015 deal lasted a few years only. Even during the years that the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action was in place, Iran had serious grievances about its implementation by Western parties. It complained that it was not receiving the economic benefits it was entitled to. And Iran seems to have learned a lesson from how the hard-earned international agreement unraveled. Since the beginning of the talks in Vienna last year, Iran has insisted that America must remove all sanctions imposed on Tehran after former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally pulled out from the deal in May 2018 in a verifiable manner. It has also demanded that Washington provide guarantees that it will not leave the JCPOA again.
Iran wants credible guarantees from the United States because the U.S. has failed to provide any critical guarantees, any credible guarantees, since the beginning of these negotiations. When the JCPOA was first being planned and negotiated back in 2015, the United States made a commitment to diplomacy and peace. Yet, in 2018, they proved that that commitment was not a guarantee by dropping out after the change of an administration. So what we find is that when Iran is talking to the United States and other Western nations that change their administrations often, and those administrations are subject to changing their positions from the last administration, then you find that Iran doesn't have any solid guarantees.
Iran says America's maximum pressure campaign has failed, and its credibility has been seriously deterred. Observers believe Washington now has to take measures to compensate for its past mistakes and regain the trust of the international community.
The Israeli regime has carried out yet another attack on the Syrian capital Damascus's countryside, killing three soldiers. Syria's state television carried the report early on Thursday, specifying the assault as a missile attack. Various media outlets had earlier reported that Syria's air defenses had confronted an Israeli airstrike around Damascus. The official Syrian Arab news agency Sana said a number of explosions had rung out over the skies of the capital and its outskirts. This is the Israeli regime's fourth attack on the Syrian soil within the space of just 2 weeks.
They consider they have the military, the diplomatic edge, and really every solution for the Israelis is not peace, but it's a technical ability to dominate and control the Palestinians.
Just a day earlier, the Arab countries said the regime had launched a missile attack on various targets on the outskirts of Syria's southwestern city of Quneitra near Syria's Tel Aviv-occupied Golan Heights. Last week, the occupying regime targeted areas surrounding Damascus and the western city of Homs.
Well, Israel pays no attention to international law. It doesn't even, I don't think, make a pretense of it. It violates international law every day in regard to the airspace of Lebanon, the airspace of Syria, the rights of the Palestinian people, and of course, in its threats against Iran.
Israel frequently targets military positions inside Syria, especially those of the resistance movement Hezbollah, which has played a key role in helping the Syrian army in its fight against the foreign-backed terrorists. Tel Aviv regime claims that its attacks target alleged supplies that are headed for the Lebanese resistance movement of Hezbollah. On countless occasions, though, the strikes have targeted reinforcement belonging to Syria's military and its allies. Tel Aviv mostly keeps quiet about its attacks on Syrian territories. Many view them as a knee-jerk reaction to the Syrian government's increasing success in confronting terrorism.
Is that Israel seeks to be the lone superpower, or you could say mini superpower of the region, as a junior partner of the big superpower, the United States. It wishes to be the dominant military force that actually exists as a country in the region. And I think that that's really what's going on here. It has nothing to do with international law, which, as I said, Israel ignores.
Israel has been a key supporter of terrorist groups that have opposed the government of President Bashar al-Assad since the foreign-backed militancy erupted in Syria in March 2011.
Our position on the status of the Golan Heights is well known, and we would like to make it clear that this position has not changed. In line with international law and relevant Security Council resolutions, notably Resolution 242 and 497, we do not recognize Israel's sovereignty over the territories occupied by Israel since June 1967, including the Golan Heights, and we do not consider them to be part of the territory of the State of Israel. Annexation of territory by force is prohibited under international law.
Syria and the Israeli regime are technically at war due to the latter's continued occupation of the Golan. The Israeli regime maintains a significant military presence in the territory, which it uses as one of its launch pads for attacks against the Syrian soil.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The handling of the Kabul strike is an ominous sign that while Biden has pledged to review the drone program, a long-standing mechanism for self-exoneration remains entrenched. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jeremy Schill, writer. This article is published under the heading The Mysterious Case of Joe Biden and the Future of Drone Wars. Stay tuned for more. At least two of the U.S. airstrikes conducted under Biden have killed civilians, including the now infamous August 29th attack in Kabul, Afghanistan, that killed 10 civilians, seven of them children. While Biden's drone strike data set is tiny, the outcome of his known strikes presents a ghastly civilian death rate. In the case of Afghanistan hits, 100% of the victims were civilians. So what is happening? Why has Biden apparently decided to pump the brakes on a two-law war that he and President Barack Obama embraced so enthusiastically? For a year, the Biden administration has been engaged in a comprehensive review of the use of drone strikes as a part of a broader evaluation of counterterrorism policy that is expected to be completed later this year or at some point in early 2022. I think the White House is appropriately wary about drone strikes, said Rosa Brooks, a former Obama administration official who worked for the Pentagon as counselor to the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy from 2009 to 2011. My sense is that they're serious about the review and are trying to minimize drone strikes, at least until there is complete clarity on internal policies, she added. Biden's predecessor, Donald Trump, did away with most of the rules the Obama administration had crafted in what Obama characterized as an effort to increase transparency, reduce civilian deaths, and establish guidelines that could give some sense of legitimacy to what was, in reality, an assassination program. Biden could have stopped at rescinding Trump's reversals and then resumed the course of regular drone strikes according to the rules developed primarily in Obama's second term. But he didn't. Instead, on the day of Biden's inauguration, his national security advisor, Jake Sullivan, quietly issued an order to roll back Trump's loosening of rules surrounding drone strikes, specifically one that bestowed on military commanders the power to authorize such strikes in undeclared war zones like Somalia and Yemen without direct permission from the White House. The Biden administration has not yet indicated whether it will revert the Obama-era guidance for strikes or craft a new policy with more robust rules, particularly surrounding the issue of civilian death. Across almost all active U.S. conflicts, we have seen a sharp fall in declared U.S. military actions under Biden, including by drone in Iraq, Syria, Somalia, Yemen, and Libya, said Chris Woods, director of the British non-governmental organization Air Wars, which tracks U.S. airstrikes and civilian deaths in many nations where the United States is engaged militarily. Woods notes that the strikes were already declining in the latter half of Trump's presidency and that Biden's early moratorium on strikes and his decision thus far to limit their use have greatly reduced civilian deaths at the hands of U.S. forces in several countries. What we don't know yet is if these trends will sustain. Publicly, the administration has yet to articulate its strategy, he said. Privately, we are hearing of the emergence of a hybrid Trump-Obama approach, which, if true, could mean less protections in place for civilians than during the latter part of Obama. That's a worry. Spokesperson for the National Security Council did not respond to a request for comment. For years, a core group of mostly progressive members of Congress have steadily sought to find legislative solutions to the excessive secrecy surrounding drone strikes and to make laws requiring more transparency from the Pentagon on civilian casualties. These efforts, which began during Obama's tenure, intensified under Trump, who made clear that he did not care about civilian deaths and, on the campaign trail in 2016, actively encouraged the killing of families of suspected terrorists. They were also a response to a renewed surge beginning in 2018 in civilian deaths in Afghanistan. In 2019, the National Defense Authorization Act established a requirement that a senior civilian within the Department of Defense be empowered to develop, coordinate, and oversee compliance with the policy of the department relating to civilian casualties resulting from United States military operations. Among the duties of this officer would be to develop and disseminate best practices for reducing civilian deaths, to establish a public internet-based mechanism for people to submit allegations of civilian harm, to ensure that standardized policies were in place for the Pentagon to acknowledge responsibility for deaths caused by U.S. military operations, and to decide whether to give ex gratia payments to the families of civilians killed as well as to those injured by U.S. operations. The Trump administration has slow-rolled the system's creation and never effectively implemented it. Even before taking office, the Biden campaign had pledged to review the use of drone strikes as part of his counterterrorism approach. Media Benjamin, co-founder of the activist group Code Pink, who has regularly traveled to countries targeted in drone strikes, said drones in particular are an inherently indiscriminate weapon. They have no place in our world. The U.S. should discontinue the use of armed drones and work through the UN for a multilateral treaty to banish them from the face of the earth, in full recognition of U.S. responsibility for unleashing this terror on humanity. There is a campaign to abolish autonomous weapons, but this doesn't go far enough. All drone warfare should be banned. At a minimum, Benjamin said, the Biden administration should immediately restart publishing the monthly air power summaries discontinued by Trump and, in fact, expand them from Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria to include all U.S. weapons releases in all countries. They should also be more comprehensive to include all types of aircraft, including helicopters, all branches of the U.S. military in the CIA and other agencies. While Benjamin and other activists have consistently focused on drones, they also recognize that drone strikes represent a small number of total U.S. airstrikes. She points to the latest statistics from Air Wars, which indicate that since Biden took office, there have been 25 U.S. airstrikes in Iraq and 14 in Syria, most of them conducted by conventional aircraft, not drones. In Somalia, according to Air Wars, Biden's 16 strikes to date have already outpaced Obama's average 7.5 per year, though they lag far behind Trump's annual average of 69. Benjamin asserted, so Biden already seems to be conducting twice as many strikes as Obama did in that country, a pattern that very likely holds in other parts of Africa too.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
If passed, the Borders and Nationality Bill will give the UK government the power to jail asylum seekers for up to 4 years if they arrive via sea routes like the English Channel, and others could be sent to a third country for processing and detention. The devolved nations Scotland and Wales have already rejected it as an anti-refugee bill, and people on the streets of London are demanding Westminster do the same.
They're putting legislation in protest in place so that they can put guns on our beaches. That's what they want to do, because the migrants that will be coming when the climate and the ecological emergency really begins to hit, we want to welcome and they want to keep out.
Britain's banks, its military, its companies across the world creating poverty, creating destruction and warfare, and when people try to flee from the consequences of that, Britain puts up fences, borders, guards to keep people out.
The bill also gives the government extraordinary powers when it comes to ethnic minorities in the UK. A proposed rule change quietly added to the bill will give the Home Secretary draconian powers over immigrants, first, second and third generation alike.
The fact of the matter is you can be born and bred legally in the UK, but if you have dual citizenship or can claim citizenship somewhere else, the British government might give itself permission to strip you of your British citizenship. In short, you're not British enough. You're a second-class citizen.
Once you are a citizen, you have the right to remain a citizen. I mean, there's many incidents. That young woman in Syria, that's such an important precedent. They groomed her. She should be brought home. She should be looked after. This is, in any other situation, this would be considered child abuse.
Shamima Begum was 15 years old when she left the UK for Syria, where she was absorbed by the Daesh terrorist group. As a second-generation Bangladeshi, she has been stripped of her citizenship and is still languishing in a Syrian refugee camp.
These are the most racist pieces of legislation we've seen in the UK in modern British history. They constitute a direct infringement on every minority's rights, giving the right for a politician to take away our citizenship and giving the government overwhelming power to decide immigration policy. We're resisting today, we'll resist tomorrow, and we invite the country to resist alongside us.
Under the new bill, the government would no longer have to inform someone they are about to lose their citizenship. This will make appealing the decision almost impossible. Rights groups say these measures are used mainly against British Muslims, but Black and Asian Britons also say they now live in fear. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Sunday, the 27th of February, has been described as a major turning point for the EU. Including fighter jets, the 27-country bloc is going to send deadly military hardware to Ukraine, which will be used against Russian forces.
For the first time ever, the European Union will finance the purchase and delivery of weapons and other equipment to a country that is under attack.
The EU has always labelled itself as a peace project. Analysts are now questioning this.
They release huge funds to buy these lethal weapons from their own industries and to supply belligerent groups to continue the conflict. I think it's absolutely shocking and it's funeral of the European project as such, because it's not more a project of peace.
Another package of sanctions against Russia and Belarus were agreed by EU foreign affairs ministers on Sunday. Some Russian banks are being blocked from the SWIFT financial payment system.
This degree of disconnection is carefully calibrated in order to create the maximum damage to the financial system of Russia.
EU airspace is being closed to all Russian aircraft, and Russian media outlets, including RT, are being banned from broadcasting in the 27-nation bloc. Also on Sunday, EU Home Affairs ministers met to discuss support for member states Poland, Slovakia, Hungary and Romania, which have witnessed flows of asylum seekers.
We have already seen more than 300,000 Ukrainians are fleeing the country, coming to the European Union.
Meanwhile, all eyes are now on the Kremlin to see how it might respond to this latest set of measures. The EU is clearly taking a calculated risk by providing deadly weapons to Ukraine. But could this lead to the crisis spiralling completely out of control? EU citizens will be hoping the risk has not been miscalculated by the bloc. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
After months of suspension, Afghan public universities have reopened. We visited Kabul University and spoke with a number of teachers and students. They say they're happy returning to the campus and hope good educational days are ahead.
We are very happy that we have returned to university again. We have been away from our classes and lessons for almost 7 months. I was longing for this day so much. This new beginning and opportunity can motivate us and give more hope for the future.
It is a big day for the young generation. The opening of the doors of universities could open the doors of developments. I hope this process continues well. I urge the international community to help our higher education sector and poor families so that their sons and daughters can get education.
Male and female students are returning to Kabul University, but in different shifts. Moreover, new roles and changes are brought by the new directors.
Actually, I witnessed a lot of changes in Kabul University. First, some departments in the fine art faculty like cinema, music, and theater are said to be cancelled. Secondly, students are obliged to change their outfits. Girls should come in the morning and boys in the afternoon. In addition, we didn't find most of our former teachers and there were new figures.
Some experts say it's not all about reopening, and there are many challenges left on the way of higher education in Afghanistan.
A huge number of our scholars, professors, and lecturers left our country during the government change. This has caused a significant loss in our higher education institutions. We need them back now. Furthermore, the Taliban government are going to make changes in universities' educational syllabuses and staff. It's uncertain where the Taliban are leading our higher education.
Like most public universities, Kabul University had closed in the immediate aftermath of the Taliban took over. Formerly, the university had remained shut for some months due to COVID-19 pandemic. The reopening of universities have brought hope to the younger generation in Afghanistan. The students here say this process must be supported in advance so that they can continue their education this year successfully. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Iran's parliament is reviewing the details of the budget bill for the next fiscal year, starting on March 21st. The government's proposed budget stands at roughly $148 billion, some 4% higher than last year's approved budget. Lawmakers have earlier approved the generalities of the budget bill, and it's been a week now since the thorough examination of the bill kicked off in parliament's open sessions.
The government's cap on next year's budget is roughly $148 billion. Out of this figure, $60 billion is allocated for the general budget and $88 billion is earmarked for government spending. Parliament is making some revisions, especially in national development projects and infrastructure. We increased the allocated budget in these areas.
This time, the budget's examination process took longer due to the fact that lawmakers want to be as meticulous as possible while evaluating the income and spending in the country.
While Iran and the P4 Plus One are engaged in tough negotiations in Vienna over the revival of the 2015 deal, President Ebrahim Raisi says the budget bill seeks to promote a resistance economy that would not need to wait for the removal of U.S. sanctions.
Parliament says the budget bill was drawn up based on a no-deal possibility in the Vienna talks and the continuation of U.S. sanctions on Iran.
The proposed budget expects the country's oil sales to reach 1.2 million barrels per day, with $60 a barrel, which would earn Iran some $14 billion in the fiscal year 2022-23. Lawmakers reset this figure to 1.4 million BPDs, with $70 a barrel. Any agreement in the ongoing Vienna talks will immediately push Iran's oil sales up by at least 500,000 BPDs as a result of the removal of U.S. oil embargoes on Iran. But lawmakers say they will not wait for the fate of the negotiations to finalize their budget bill, saying any extra petrodollar will be spent for the good of the people.
We cannot waste our time and wait if the U.S. removes the sanctions or not. So we set the budget based on a daily export of 1.4 million barrels of oil through direct or barter sales, and based on assumptions that oil prices will hover around $70, when in fact the prices are reaching $100. Any extra oil income will be saved in a national development fund.
President Ibrahim Raisi submitted the budget bill to Parliament in mid-December last year, when Parliament approved its general outlines. Lawmakers now have 3 weeks to go over the details and fix the shortcomings of the budget, to pass it into law, before handing it to the higher legislative body, the Constitutional Council, for final approval. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
EU foreign affairs ministers held talks in Brussels to bolster the 27-nation bloc's second round of new sanctions against Russia over the Kremlin's military campaign in Ukraine.
Only leaders in the world who are sanctioned by the European Union, Assad from Syria, Lukashenko from Belarus, and now Putin from Russia.
Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has also been added to the sanctions list. The idea is to block banks in the EU from making funds available to the two key Russian figures. Earlier on Friday, EU leaders agreed sanctions on Russia's energy, aviation and financial sectors.
We're now targeting 70% of the Russian banking market, but also key state-owned companies, including the field of defence.
Outside the EU leaders' summit, union members staged a peace demonstration.
We don't think to have a war in Ukraine is a good thing for European workers and for Ukrainian workers. So we don't agree with the war.
Leaders from the 30-country NATO alliance held a summit on Friday. The big question is, could moves by the West stoke the flames and turn this crisis into a catastrophe?
NATO allies have and continue to provide support, military, but also different types of equipment to Ukraine.
US troops under the NATO flag have just arrived in Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania. Moscow had requested less provocation from NATO, but it appears those calls continue to fall on deaf ears. According to some analysts, one positive fallout from the crisis could be greater independence for the EU when it comes to foreign policy. The point has been made, there will be a realisation in the coming months. It is dangerous and extremely costly economically to allow Washington dictate relations between neighbours on the other side of the Atlantic. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The tea break young girls working at the Central Market in the heart of New Delhi. They say things have changed significantly since the December 2012 gang rape. Now the streets of Delhi are safer for women, as we can see the change. But more needs to be done, considering the population of the city. These working girls are excited to see the new pink booth launched by the Delhi police to make the city safer for girls and women.
Women are more secure nowadays. Police helpline number we are given, and I think last week they have opened several police booth, pink police booth in local market near places where we can directly complain women have.
Although the initiative started a week ago, the drive is gaining a gradual popularity across the city. The booths are staffed with all women police officers filing complaints on the spot, mainly in the crowded markets, besides helping female commuters with any sort of problems they face while shopping. The initiative has received an overwhelming response from citizens, especially on the social media. Now calls are growing across the country for similar booths for women and girls in distress, since the office provides them with the on-spot help. Indian women live in a constant barrage of threats ranging from rape, torture, abduction, stalking, domestic violence, dowry deaths and other forms of violence. The administration in recent years adopted a string of stringent measures as a result of large-scale